My name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Richard.
My name is Kyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kyle.
And we both are very grateful to be here. It's been a big highlight for us, and you know, we want to thank everyone who's coming out on this rainy day to kind of stick with us through this kind of thicket of an adventure through the Big Book. One member, I believe, described it early on. She said, "You guys do an excruciating version of the Big Book." You know what I mean? And I think excruciating is a good word because we've really, you know, spent a lot of time on material. We weren't concerned so much with, oh, we got to get through the whole 12 steps. We said, you know, we have to do the material justice where it sits. I don't want to move on to something until we have, you know, really kind of thoroughly examined something else. Because we talked a lot early on in this book about, even though a lot of people say it's the first 164 pages, we know that after we read the page 104, we've already finished working with others. We've done the 12 steps. And through the employers, the chapter to the wise, and a vision for you are very interesting side sets, but the entire program of recovery is really based on 104 pages. And we also found out that the doctor's opinion in the version first one of the book was actually page 1. And that if We Agnostics doesn't start till 44, and you add those 10 pages back into the book, that basically half of this book is dedicated to the proposition of accepting or admitting to my innermost self that I have this disease, because that's the one thing that's going to be critical and pivotal in my ability to go forward and have some recovery. So we didn't kind of rush through anything trying to find a way, you know, maybe we could cut through this or cut through that, because we felt that all the material was very important, and these first, you know, 50 pages of the book are set up to kind of examine a proposition and to lay out these simple set of spiritual tools for us. And that's really what we hope to accomplish. We hope on this journey that we've been taking together, you've picked up some interesting things on the way. Maybe a new perspective on looking at something that maybe you've traditionally looked at in a different way. We've never claimed at any point of our discourse here, or discourses, that we had the definitive version of what recovery looked like. We are just sharing how it looked like for us and hoping it resonates with you. We acknowledge the fact that each person has their own spiritual path and that that path looks like different things. We even found places in the Big Book that said, you know what, if someone just doesn't drink and go to meetings, that's okay. Because that's working for them. Because we know to the extent that we needed a spiritual solution for this program was directly correlated to how much we had lost the power of choice when it came to drinking. So I'm not here to decide or define for any other person, you know, how much of the power of choice you have lost or retained. I am not here, you know, we quit playing God. We're not on the judgment society. This is the right way, that is the wrong way. So we've kind of tried to really labor on those points as we go forward. We've also done a very excruciating review of all the things we've done to the point each week to get us back to where we are. So we're not going to be excruciatingly laboring, but I'm going to throw Kyle a curveball here, Colin. I'm going to say we've picked up some snippets on the way. Like, for instance, from the doctor's opinion, we picked up the physical allergy, right?
This is true.
And what else did we pick up?
We picked up two other main points. They alluded to this idea of a mental obsession, right? That I wake up the next morning, my bed is wet, my face hurts, and I still think never again, and then an hour later, I think, well, maybe this time will be different. The third big takeaway, it doesn't talk about anything other than the fact that I need this psychic change, this drastic and utter transformation, right? Then if the doctor's opinion is the definition of a problem, then Bill's story was the example of the problem, right? And we asked you in the first 8 pages, where did I think like Bill? Where did I act like Bill? Where did I drink like Bill? Second 8 pages into the recovery portion, we asked, would you be willing to do what Bill did? What did Bill do? He destroyed his pride. Debbie told him to come up with his own conception of God, to abandon everything he thought he knew. Right, because he's sitting there at death's door and he still has some ideas about what he thinks he knows. And that's just a quick road to a drink.
Right, so we picked up some snippets about intellectual pride. The biggest barrier to Bill to be connecting to this God was all these preconceived notions that he came into this with. He admitted he was hopeless, but yet still had opinions about what he felt God was about. So that need to dismiss the, you know, and the second snippets when we talked about the next 8 pages, we talked about would you be willing to do what Bill did, and Bill put aside some of his old prejudices. He actually quotes, he says, some of the vestiges of my old prejudices started to dissolve. And some of those notions he had about what was God and war and all this stuff, he realized that these were just the defenses that he was putting up. And once he let those dissolve, he was able to open himself up to a real good experience. Then we moved on. You know, once again, we want to just briefly cap on this stuff. And we came to there, it's a solution. So, doctor's opinion, definition of problem, Bill's story, description of problem, and there is a solution. Wow, there is a solution, is the solution to the problem. And we found out that the first 8 pages of the problem, and there is a solution, had nothing to do with what the solution was, but actually was just talking a lot more about what an alcoholic is. So that just underscored in our minds this urgent need to identify oneself as having this illness. Because right now, the big solution that turns out, you know, that big third wheel, the thing that Bill needed, that secret ingredient we talked about, was he moved from, I have self-knowledge, I have willpower, but those things did him no good whatsoever, right? What he needed was that third element, he had self-knowledge, he had willpower, and what he really needed was that spiritual component. Now, the spiritual component we find, or I find, is extremely difficult in our era as we live as people, because most people, when you start to talk about God, develop a certain antipathy. They kind of push it off because we live in the era of the iPhone, where everything is scientifically explainable. And if you can't come up with a scientific rationalization for why something is, it's very difficult for people to believe. God has been kind of pushed to the point of being like a Santa Claus kind of creature, you know, where we see that people really don't have that type of faith, or I don't have that type of faith necessary to create that change. So this is a kind of like a big proposition to get with. And that's why when we go to We Agnostics, which we're going to explore next week, we're really going to open that and explore what that means for us. We went to more about alcoholism, right? So even the solution says, okay, 8 pages, the problem, more the problem. A few pages, hey, by the way, the solution is you really need a spiritual connection. Then why don't they just launch right into We Agnostics? Answer: they still don't believe that we believe that we're alcoholics. So we're going to have to come with more about alcoholism. And we heard the story about the guy with, what was that story again?
The man of 30 who stopped early on in life, stopped drinking for a long time, right? And we asked you, did you ever stop? For me, I remember clearly I stopped for like 3 days and thought, I got this, you know? That was a long time for me. But this guy stopped for a long, long time, and he died drunk. Right, because that what we're trying to enforce here, what we're trying to get you to recognize, this idea that abstinence does not equal cured, period. The other thing, the thing it doesn't talk about too much that I'm really dying to know, is what kind of person was he for these 30 years? Because he's probably a real alcoholic, right? Which we talked about on page 20 and 21, right? The different types of drinkers. And so if you're a real alcoholic and you're not working this kind of program, I know my first 6 months clean, I wasn't doing any work, and I was a miserable person, you know? So I'm dying to know, because I'm curious and nosy, but like, I'm dying to know, what was his attitude like during these 20-odd years that he was clean? And then he quit, he retired, started drinking, and in a very short time, he was dead. Next story we
moved on. Wait, no, and that snippet reveals this, right? Remember that wonderful reveal at the end of the man of 30 comes in the form of a powerful lesson, which is what, Carl?
This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally, right? We're trying to hammer home. We talked about early on that each paragraph was basically devoted to the mental obsession in this chapter, or the physical allergy, and this is our common insanity. Right, everyone who is alcoholic has this thought in the back of their mind that maybe someday I'll be able to drink like a gentleman, right? Like I'll get two fingers and just sip it nicely, you know? That's never, ever going to happen.
So then one of the big myths that it's trying to dispel right away, which I think I use a lot and many people use, is that if I have a period of abstinence, I can drink like a normal person and I can't really be an alcoholic. Well, but we know from the descriptions about the alcoholic, right, that, you know, what about the real alcoholic? He may or may not start off as a casual drinker. So that means it doesn't matter that if I could put some sobriety time with me, it's not a matter of frequency, it's a matter of intensity. It's not how often I drink that defines me as an alcoholic. Most people have a common misconception that an alcoholic is a person that must drink every day, that sleeps in a box on the Bowery, and blah, 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 blah. But no, can you be an alcoholic and only drink on the weekends? Yes, you can, because the key here is not frequency, but intensity. Once I start to drink, do I have very little control over how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to stop? If that's true, you may be an alcoholic. Once I stop and swear I'll never start again, you know, and then find this insanely trivial reason to drink again, this is another telltale sign. That has nothing to do with drinking every day. No, I'm going to leave that alone because we want to motor through it. Oh, we talked about the notion is we've been talking a lot. We really have. We burned you guys out for weeks talking right to the hour, sometimes leaving you 5 minutes. So Kyle and I decided this week we want to really hear what you got to say. We're especially interested in hearing from people who are counting days, and we want to know, is this material getting through? Is it making sense to you? Or are we just kind of blowing a lot? Do we sound like Charlie Brown's teacher? Wow, 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 you know, in the cartoon. Because I think a lot of times, you know, when you start listening to people talking, they start sounding like Charlie Brown's teacher. So we want to make sure that we're not sounding like Charlie Brown's teacher to the people counting days. And we want to hear from the new people, and we want to hear from the old people. We want to hear from the people that have been around and that know it. Now, we're going to do Fred, but you want to briefly do Jim before I could quickly do it if you'd like. Kyle, what do you want to do?
You can do it, because I think I'm starting off Fred. So.
Oh, okay, yeah, you're going to start with Fred, so I get to do Jim. So we found out some more stories. Here's some more stories, like a proof of the purchase kind of thing, right? Jim, right, is the partner in a business that he used to own. He works for a business he used to own. And his story is kind of filled with resentment. He's angry about a lot of things. And something happens to him, suddenly happens to him, right? But we got at the core of Jim's story. It said, you know, he understood. What's that? Oh, no, we're just recapping more about alcoholism, so this is 36, so we're not actually going through the book yet. So, there she is, Miss Excruciating, come and sit down. So, you know, we found out about Jim and his story, that he was a bit resentful, but one of the things they identified right away, and we believe this is like the proof of concept in the story, is that failure to enlarge his spiritual experience was at the cause of his problem. Jim walked away with self-knowledge, right? He walked away with self-knowledge. He had all the, you know, he had a lot of willpower, right? But yet he couldn't make that necessary change. Now remember, it says in the book, it says, at certain times, the alcoholic will not be able to recall with sufficient force the pain, misery, and suffering of even a week or a month ago. And they will be without effective mental defense against that drink. So it doesn't say all the time. It says at certain times. So let's say 99% of the time you're able to recall what happened to you and you say, I'm never going to drink again. We're not interested in those times. We're interested in that one time that you're unable to recall with sufficient force. Because if we're going to offer anything like a real solution to alcoholism, we have to have some kind of effective mental defense against that drink. And we already established that when Jim had suddenly happened to him, the last thing he was thinking of is, let me call my sponsor. And he definitely wasn't thinking, let me go to a meeting. And so it all came down to his relationship with that higher power at the end, because that's really what it comes down to, you know. And if that experience or if that relationship is not right, it's going to be a problem. Now, before we go on to Fred, right, I have to tell a story. I want to tell a story. Alcoholics Anonymous is a tradition, an oral tradition kind of organization. We don't have any new stories. I don't have any profound new knowledge. I am merely a person who has, I have stood on the shoulders of giants. And I've been a good listener. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an expression, we learn to listen and we listen to learn. You know, when we're out there drinking and drugging, maybe the best thing that we could do was merely wait for our turn to speak. You know, everyone would be talking, and I really wasn't hearing anything anybody had to say. I was just merely waiting for my turn to speak because what I said was important and what you said was insignificant. Right? But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn to listen and we listen to learn. And as we do that, right, things are revealed to us and we pass them along. Right? So, I'm coming up on 19 years next month. Right? Oh, great, Rich. But the point being is, I was thinking a lot about why am I still sober and why have so many other people that I know dead in jail, not sober? Why is that? Right? It's like Weight Watchers. I don't know if anyone's ever been to Weight Watchers. Do you gotta, I'm sure everybody that walks into Weight Watchers and puts down that money on the counter absolutely wants to lose weight. 100% they want to lose weight. But not everybody that goes to Weight Watchers loses weight. Is it that they don't have the intention? Everyone has the intention. Surely you put the money down there. You want that to happen. But it doesn't work for everybody. What's the big difference? Well, there are certain people that walk into Weight Watchers and they have a firm resolve. They are 100% committed. They are all in, all the time. That's the way they roll. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, for this to work, you got to be all in, all the time. You know, my company does a lot of events, and we hosted an event of a Navy SEAL. And he was on the Osama bin Laden team, and he wrote a book and everything. But the one thing that he said that resonated with me, he said, that's how it is in the SEALs. We are all in, all the time. There's no such thing as half-stepping this, kind of almost doing it. We are all in, all the time. And I thought to myself, that's the way you get sober, when you're all in, all the time. People that go to Weight Watchers that are all in all the time, they lose weight. People that walk into AA, you know, all in all the time, they get sober. So that's going to be a key ingredient here. But I want you to remember that. Firm resolve. You know, but how do you get to firm resolve? You hit the rock bottom. But we already know that every rock bottom has a trap door. So when do you know you hit rock bottom? It's when you're all in. All the time. You're not making any questions. You're not sitting there going, look, I'm hopeless, but I have some ideas about who God is and who God is not. You're admitting that. Right? The key for me to see people that get sober is when they really understand the notion of let go or be dragged. And that's exactly what my addiction does to me. It drags me down. But I must let go. So that, and now we're going to go through the Fred story. But I want you to keep that in the back of your mind because it's going to be, we're going to keep recalling it. Hopefully we're going to get an end early and we want to hear from you guys. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with disagreeing with anything we've said. It's the healthy aspect of a lively discussion that helps us to grow as an organization. If we all just sit here and absorb the party line, that's not going to be as helpful as we have nice discussions, meaningful dialogue about what is and what is not truthful for us. We learn to listen. We listen to learn. We want feedback, but we warn everybody, we give feedback on feedback. So with that, I'll turn it over to Colin. We could actually start the reading.
Which is what page 39, middle of the page. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good, he has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet, he is alcoholic. So again, we're touching on this idea of, you know, I know I used to think of alcoholics as the guy's brown bagging it on the street when I was going to cop or coming home from work. Like, that's clearly a drunk. Fred, likable guy, hard worker, married, nice family life, he's an alcoholic. Because it's not about your living situation, right? We keep touching on this and touching on this. It's about what happens when you drink. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves, incapable of telling the truth. Here he is in the hospital, shaking, and he's lying to himself. I'm just relaxing, taking a little vacation from the world, right? The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would help keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it, because we've already seen just how great self-knowledge is at keeping a real alcoholic sober, right? I wonder how that works out.
Right?
I wonder how keeping it green works out for him.
And also the memory. You know, he thought, if I could just keep the experience of what happened to me green in my heart, if I could remember. And you hear that a lot. You hear people say, you know, just play the tape. Just remember. If I can remember how bad my last drink was, I won't take my next drink, whatever. It's. I don't question the fact that it works for some or whatever. It just never worked for me. Because once again, 99 out of 100 times, remembering that painful experience, that humiliating thing that happened to me, works. But we're not looking for 99% recovery, right? We're looking for 100% this is going to work. So we're looking to say, well, how do I fill that little gap, that little tiny spot that when suddenly happens? Notice how Fred's story, once again, keeps reinforcing. The first one was about he failed to enlarge his spiritual experience. This is a little bit about denial. And he goes on and we heard no more from Fred for a while. One day, we're told that he was back in the hospital. This time, he was quite shaky and soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us was instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking and had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all other concepts, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Once again, this is not a bottom-out Bowery drunk. This is a successful working person, right? This is a guy who has a family and kids, and it's kind of dispelling these myths. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed by what you fellows said about alcoholism. I've heard that before. And I frankly did not believe it could be possible for me to drink again. It's unbelievable. Look at me. I am Fred. I'd rather appreciated your ideas of the subtle insanity. Thank you for the information, which precedes the first drink. But I was confident that could it not happen to me. After all, after what I had learned, after all this knowledge, I reasoned that I was not as far advanced as you fellows. Meaning, you guys were messed up. I didn't that bad. You know, and then I remember when I first came home from Alcoholics Anonymous, first meeting. I walked to the refrigerator, cracked a beer, told my mom, my wife, I said, honey, I got some good news and bad news. She said, what's the bad news? I said, I'm alcoholic. She said, what's the good news? I ain't that bad. And because I really thought that I kept looking at other people going, these people are really terrible people. I am Fred. I am a working guy. And so that inability to recognize myself as an alcoholic is the problem that Fred's having, and it's a problem that I had, and it's a problem that many of you might have had yourself, just in this incredible state of denial, because no one wants to admit that they're bodily different than other people. None of us want to think, oh my God, I can't drink. Right? So he goes on and he says, I felt I had every right to be self-confident. that I would, it was only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. So the story is talking about willpower and self-knowledge. These are the two things that Fred went out in the world armed with. But was it going to be enough? Well, Kyle, you tell us. Was it going to be enough, Kyle?
In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Right? So with Jim's story, you know, he was so resentful. He was such a miserable person, right? Working for the business he used to own. Now here we have Fred, who's never felt better in his life. He just had an awesome day, right? But he doesn't have that secret ingredient. And at certain times, suddenly is going to happen, right? He's happy as hell. He just had this amazing day. And then suddenly.
Now, I know I said I was going to give Kyle all the squiggly lines, but I got a little resentful. And I made my amends, and Kyle gave me a few squiggly lines. Thank you, Kyle.
You're very welcome.
Okay. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to my mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and the meal. Remember when we saw at the beginning of these two stories, there was a little kind of setup paragraph that said something like, you know, we're wondering what goes through the mind of a person who knows of all these things, but yet it happens. So in the next two stories, we're going to tell you like what's going through the head of that person when that suddenly happens. And so far, the answer seems to be not that much. You know, it's just not that much. There's not much thinking going in there. We also said, you know, when the guy with the milk and the whiskey put it in his mouth, he said, I reasoned this was not too, not too good. It wasn't when he was like looking at the cup, this is not too good. It was like he was drinking. I reasoning this is not too good. You know what I mean? It's like way too late after the reasoning kind of happens. Because suddenly it's just kind of happening. Now, when he ordered that cocktail, was he saying, you know, I was thinking something came to my mind. It would be nice to have a cocktail at dinner. So then I decided I'm going to call my sponsor. Or I got an old AA meeting book out. I'm going to go to a meeting. No, he doesn't mention anything about that, does he? And now, here's a little tricky part about it, too, because sometimes, you know, you take a drink, and then you wait a little while, and you say, you know what, I wasn't, you know, it was okay, it worked, right? So he didn't keep drinking, he ordered a cocktail, and then he ordered another after dinner, he decided to take a walk. He didn't say, I took a walk with a bunch of beer in my hand, he just took a walk. Maybe he walked about 15, 20 minutes, whatever. But when he returned to the hotel, it struck him that a highball would be fine going to bed. So the buzz was kind of wearing off. And he thought, hey, you know, why not? Not much thinking there going on, right? I remember having several more the night before and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being on an airplane. Once again, not an alien, not a blackout, an alien abduction, right? And finding a friendly taxicab driver landing on the field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me around for several days. That must have cost a pretty penny. I know little of where I went and what I did and said, and that's how he knew it wasn't, remember, it's intensity, not frequency. Then came the hospital and the unbearable mental and physical suffering. There he is again. And then Kyle, to make my amends, I said you could have the next squiggly line.
Thank you. It's very important to me. I enjoy them. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight against the first drink whatsoever. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. No playing the tape through, no keeping it green. When suddenly happened what was going on in his head, not bloody much. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. If this is huge, right? Who works with newcomers in here? Has this ever worked with you? You're alcoholic, for the love of God, and you try to shake it into him, it doesn't work. They said, look, I'm alcoholic. If you're alcoholic, this is what happens to us. They didn't say, look, you're alcoholic, because again, we've spent 7 weeks now trying to get, because we said we would take you through it as if you were a newcomer, trying to get you to self-diagnose, to identify with some of these thoughts and these feelings, right? If you have an alcoholic mind, this is what's going to happen, because this is what happens to us. Without this secret ingredient, you're going to drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. Sounds like all the self-knowledge he had failed him. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. So now, finally, this sounds like rock bottom. This sounds like he might just finally have that desire that Rich was talking about. He might finally want it.
And remember the story about the Weight Watchers? Remember I was talking about the desire, when we get to the desire. Now all of a sudden Fred seems to be at that place where he has the genuine desire. So maybe many times, you know, I tried to stop and I had the knowledge and I had the willpower, but my desire, you know, they say in the doctor's opinion, it says we'll lie so much to ourselves we will not be able to tell the truth from the false. And that invites a question. The question is, if as an alcoholic I could lie to myself about circumstances, situations, people, whatever, right, can I do that as a sober person? And I believe the answer is yes. I can lie to myself about wanting to lose weight. I can lie to myself about wanting to get sober. It's just, I want to believe it when I say I want to get sober. I really mean it, but I have this disease of the mind. Remember back in the book, it said, you know, about the physical allergy, that the observations would be academic and pointless if our fellow never picked up the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, we have concluded that the problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. So now I have this mental problem, that I'm unable to accept either the reality that I have alcoholism or muster the real desire to stop, because I, once again, I get back to that notion of how come some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and don't get sober? How come some people come and get sober? I still keep linking it back to that notion of I really want this. I really want this. When you really want something, you go for it. And you're all in all the time. Like, a good story would be, I always wanted to learn how to play the piano. Really did. But I never took any piano lessons. I never even looked in the paper for how much it cost to buy a piano. So I never took any of the actions that are associated with it. So just wanting this is great to begin with. But I have to be willing to take a lot of action and put a lot of effort into it. And now he's got to that point where maybe he's ready to do some business. And that's why I'm a terrible sponsor, because I only look for people that are ready to do business with me. If you're not ready to do business, I'm kind of like, okay, let me know how the field research goes and come back. I'll be here waiting for you. Okay, then I get two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much, and asked me if I thought myself a real alcoholic and were really licked this time. I asked Kyle to let me talk about this, because this is exactly what happened to me. I sometimes I'll do something called passing the buck. And I get a guy who I'm pretty sure doesn't really want it, but has given me the lip service that they want to go through the program. And I know some other guy who I just took through the work who needs a sponsee. And I say, okay, my first request of you is to work with this guy. go through the steps with him. Because, you know, it's a matter of, it's not a matter of, oh my God, I went through them with Rich. Or, you know, it's just a matter of going through them. And when you're ready to hear, you can hear. And when you ain't ready to hear, you just can't hear. Okay? When you're ready to hear, the wino on the Bowery is going to become like Yoda. And when you are not ready to hear, Bill W. is going to sound like Charlie Brown's teacher. It's just a matter of the reality of it. So I sent him to him. He relapsed. I'm not blaming the guy I put him with. The guy I put him with had good recovery, understood the steps. But he came to my house crying, his eyes out, just bawling in church, said he just, the night before, wrecked the company truck into a telephone pole, ran home in tears, absolutely ready to get sober, 100%. I looked at him. He had that look on his face that I just love to see. I love that look because I know that's it. This is what I call low-hanging fruit. So I just go in and I say, boom, okay, I'm going to sponsor. And I laugh right in the guy's face. He said to me, what are you laughing about? I said, I'm laughing because I'm very happy for you. Because I know you're ready now. Now you're ready to be all in, all the time. So that was great. Thank you for letting me have that. So then he asked me if I was licked, and the guy said, I had to concede to both propositions. Okay, he's surrendering. Once again, let go or be dragged. Right? He says, they piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentally, such as I had exhibited in Washington, was in a hopeless condition. Can you imagine how many times they've been through that experience where people told them, thanks for the knowledge, buddy, I got it from here. I'll take it, just give me the wheels of that car. They cited cases and cases of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of the conviction that I could do the job myself. Snuffed out the last flicker of conviction. Burned to the innermost soul to believe, ultimately, without any shadow of a doubt, that I have this and I want this, is the basic requirement in my mind to get sober for me. For my mind to help anyone get sober is to see that. And when you see that, be that person's sponsor, because you're going to have an easy sponsee. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Oh, I get to do that too, right? Oh, good, yeah. Which I have been brought into a way of life infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful in life than I lived before. Once again, both of the stories underscore the notion that willpower and self-knowledge in and of themselves are not going to suffice it. The first guy, the preface was failure to enlarge his spiritual experience. The second guy, the discovery that spiritual principles would solve my life. Once again, what is this all doing? It's setting us up for the big thing, the big hard sell proposition. And that hard sell proposition is this thing that, you know, the power greater than myself that I choose to call God. Right? So then, you're going to talk a little bit about that, right, Colin?
Before we jump to 43, I just wanted to briefly touch on page 42. Then they outline the spiritual answer and program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully. We promised we wouldn't hit you with the God hammer just yet, but ultimately, it's right there, right? Ours is not an idle program. I needed to do this work because as a direct result of it, I was put into contact with a power greater than myself. And it's not enough, you know, just to have one or the other. I can't just, like, pray my ass off and not ever inventory or make prompt amends or try to practice all of these principles in all of my affairs. It's not enough. Well, I took inventory today, you know, and I was really prompt about making my amends today and not have any spirituality whatsoever because I need that in my life. You know, and ultimately the proposals they explained to him intellectually were not hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. Here he is, he's at death's door, and he's still like, I don't know if I'm ready to do that kind of sorta, you know? Who are you to say? Do you want this? We keep talking about desire. Are you willing to go to whatever lengths it takes. I need to stop talking about that, or we are going to drop the God hammer, and that's for next week. On 43, Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. It takes a lot for us to have that desire. I know what it took me to have that desire to stop. You know, it takes a lot of us a lot of crap before we really want it. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you, if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. I just love this one particular, the first sentence in this paragraph. You know, last fall I was interviewing to find a GP, because as a sober person, you know, I go to the doctor now, you know, and I was finding a new shrink, and they all have kittens when they find out I'm an AA. Like, all right, so, you know, you go through the rigmarole, I'm clean now, please don't prescribe me anything crazy, I'm two and a half years clean and sober. And they're like, oh, how'd you do? I'm in AA. They're like, nice, keep doing that. You know, they love it. A lot of them don't get it. I don't need them to get it. I need them to say, okay, cool, keep doing you. Because we talked about this earlier. Nothing else really explained this the way this explained it. Nothing else worked for me other than this. So every time I tell a doctor that I'm in AA and they enjoy that, it's fun for me, you know.
Before we kind of close it out a little bit back in what Kyle was talking about, most of us have to be badly mangled before we could really commence to solve their problem. That gets back to that notion we're talking about a little bit last week, that, you know, we identified that some people could have stopped early on in their career. The problem was that they didn't have enough desire at that time. Like, in other words, like the old dog rule, many of us got warning flags early on and could have stopped, but the consequences weren't severe enough. So we're here with the good news is you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait till you lose everything to stop. You know, there are two ways people learn in life. One is from reference and the other is from experience. Right, the reference we make when you look at what we're saying and you say, oh, I understand Rich and Kyle's experience, they went through it, I believe it, I don't have to do that. Right? The other is experiential. I don't believe you, I have to go there myself. And unfortunately for alcoholism and drug addiction, it's about the experience. I must burn my hand before I realize that the fire is no good. But the unfortunate thing is that, you know, sometimes that burning can be absolutely seething and can go on for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So the good news here is that if you can learn referentially, if you can look at Kyle and myself and say, hey, I believe those guys, you could stop right now. Mm-hmm. You could stop right now. And, you know, you can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. I always say in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a baseball analogy I like to use. If you're 16 years old or 15 years old and decide you have a little bit of physical talent and you decide you want to play in the Major League Baseball team and you work your ass off for 5-7 years and you eat, sleep, drink baseball, chances are you're going to be a Major League Baseball player, right? Make that same decision when you're 25. Right, and then work that same 7 years. You might be in the minor leagues. You might be in a AAA ball situation. Make that same decision when you're 35. You might be playing AAA ball. You might be on a bar league. Make that same decision when you're 40. You'll be coaching a baseball team somewhere. You know, the love and passion for baseball will come through. But as you wait longer and longer, life will start to take things off the table for you. You will no longer be able to do that. This is no longer an option for you. You can get sober at 68 years old, absolutely, and you can help other alcoholics to stay sober, and you can have a great life. But if you wait till that long before you make that move, I guarantee you a lot of things will be taken off the table for you. And it's not a matter of if, it's just a plain fact. All right? So then to end this soliloquy, I would like to say the big sales pitch comes again as the big close happens once more. The alcoholic at certain... Once more! How many times more do we have to hear this? That the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Now, I got to tell this story, right, Carl? All right. The standard deviation. I take a cup of a jar of salt and I pour it on the ground, right? Right in the middle. The biggest part of the pile. That's where 90% or 80% of the salt's going to fall, right? That's about it, right? One, like a quarter of an inch away from that. That's going to be the second pile of most salt is going to fall. That's the one standard deviation away from the norm. And as the salt gets further out and the pile gets thinner, we start to get into more standard deviations, right? It's the bell curve. There's one grain of salt that shoots out past the table and goes way at the other end of the table and sits there, right? And somehow, for some strange reason, I think, that's me. I'm the exception. It's me. I'm not going to get cancer from smoking cigarettes. No! That's everyone else. I'm the outlier. I love to believe I'm the outlier. I'd love to believe that I'm the exception to the rule. But the bottom line is, this is all about accepting the fact that I am a garden variety alcoholic. That I am not some kind of exception to the rule, that I am just like everybody else, and I am not immune from all the things that are going to happen if I can't get with this program. And it says, so, except in a few rare cases, so I love that because we're all rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. What does that mean? This is human aid, this meeting. My sponsor is human aid. That I cannot provide you with an effective defense against the first drink. Your defense must come from a higher power. Well, what are we going to do, Charlie? What are we going to do? We're going to read We Agnostics next week. And before we open it up for you, I have a homework assignment. The homework assignment is, when you go home, right, Bill was asked to write down his own interpretation of, God of his own understanding. Right? Everybody should think about that for next week. Who is this God of your understanding? When you think of God, like I said, I always used to think of God as like Charlton Heston in the Ten Commandments was what God looked like. God sat on Abraham Lincoln's chair in Washington. Jesus was the vice president. The apostles were the Supreme Court. And the angels made up the Congress and the Senate. You know, that's the way in my mind it was. So I had to change that concept, right? So we want to now open up. We wish we could have left more time. Well, like I said, we want to hear from new people to find out, hey, is this message getting through or do we sound like Charlie Brown's teacher? We want to hear from the people who have more experience. Hey, what the hell are you guys talking about? Because we certainly are open to any kind of feedback like that. And the threat I told Kyle, I said, don't worry, if no one talks, I'll say, if no one raises their hand, I'm going to continue sharing. Okay? So with that, we're going to go to a show of hands.
Beautiful. The meeting is now open for comments, questions, and observations.